Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of President Obama's apparent strong card in this election, his foreign policy, that so far does not seem to be a winning issue in this presidential campaign. James Mann, a former foreign correspondent with the Los Angeles Times, who is author in residence at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, joins us. He's the author of the new book, The Obamians, The Struggle Inside the White House to Redefine American Power. Then we will speak with Tom Hayden, a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society, who later served 18 years in the California legislature. He has been in close contact with Julian Assange's defense team, and we will examine the limited legal options open to the WikiLeaks founder, who addressed the world today from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he is holed up, calling on the United States to end its witch hunt against WikiLeaks. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of The Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. We will discuss the increasing rumors of war coming from Israel that an attack on Iran is imminent and examine the possible consequences of the targeting of leadership and nuclear and rocket scientists, which are contained in an alleged leak of Israeli war plans. Joining us now is James Mann, a former Washington reporter, columnist, and foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's the author in residence at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he's the author of many books on global affairs and U.S. foreign policy, including The Rise of the Vulcans, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, The China Fantasy, and his latest book just out is The Obamians, The Struggle Inside the White House to Redefine American Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Mann.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Now, the foreign policy, as I mentioned in the opening, seems to be the strong card, particularly the having killed bin Laden, etc. But it doesn't seem to be translating. Is that something that's endemic with American elections, that it's not, foreign policy is not really a strong card, or is this just not getting any traction?
Well, I see it a little differently. It's not that it is failing to work for Obama. I think it's failing to work for the challenges to him. Romney has sort of failed to make a foreign policy challenge to Obama, and the nomination of Ryan just is, in a way, confirms that foreign policy is not what he's going to concentrate on. It is different from other campaigns. There are many campaigns in which foreign policy is an issue. Obama was his main issue in 2008, and certainly candidates like Reagan, or if you go to the 72 campaign on Vietnam, there are a lot of campaigns in which foreign policy is a big issue.
Well, it's pretty clear that this is going to be a close election. I think obviously if President Obama had. If he gets the same votes that he got in 2008, I think it would be a landslide. But the sense is that the Republicans are leveling the playing field by an aggressive amount of money that's being spent through super PACs, unprecedented amounts of money. Suppression of the vote, I think 5 million people have been struck off the rolls. There's a chance that the lack of enthusiasm, if you will, from those who were swept up in the idea of hope and change in 2008 and who are disappointed now, and frankly, a lot of the Republican commercials in this campaign have indicated that aren't you disappointed and that he didn't deliver, etc. What's your just general reading, James Mann, of how this election's going? Because in many ways it feels as though that perhaps in 2008 President Obama promised too much and he may well pay for it in 2012.
Well, a couple things. You're making a good point. In general, my observation on the failure of Romney to create any kind of coherent challenge on foreign policy. That's true. The point you make is that because of foreign policy, former Obama supporters or Obama supporters are less enthusiastic about Obama than they used to be. And I, you know, I can't tell, we can't tell what the turnout's going to be. It can be that people who no longer see Obama in as hopeful terms as they did will still feel every bit as strongly as before that the Democratic candidate is preferable to the Republican candidate. In fact, they may feel that this election is even more important than last. So you don't see the excitement out there because it's really an incumbent president. But I'm not sure yet that that's going to influence the election.
Well, one of the things that might influence the election is, I mean, I mentioned the unprecedented amount of money that's being spent and the extent to which already, according to the Brennan Center, 5 million eligible Democrats may not be able to vote. I mean, it does seem a kind of extraordinary paradox that Americans who have voted before and who are eligible to vote and who want to vote Democrat have to jump through hoops, whereas billionaires who are essentially buying the election for the Republicans don't have to reveal who they are. That is the state we're in terms of what would seem to me to be a kind of a disparity or not a particularly level playing field. But that's what we have in this year. This seems to be the year of the money, isn't it, James Mann?
I hope not. I agree on the billionaires. On the voter suppression, I don't think we should get into
right
sort of believing that this election is doomed before we actually see what happens and people get registered to vote. I think it becomes a way of giving up on the election, which is in some ways a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. Well, it also, you know, as you said earlier, a lot of people have already given up on Obama too. So there is a passivity on the Democratic side and a great sense of activism on the Republican side. That much appears to me to be the situation. But what about a wild card here in terms of foreign policy coming back front and center in this election with what is now being rumored in the Israeli press at a fevered pitch now, the notion that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak are intent on attacking Iran possibly soon and before the elections. That's a wild card that's pretty hard to determine the outcome, surely.
I agree that if that happens, who knows what the implications are going to be. I still don't think it's going to happen. But yeah, if that happened in the first place, you could have a major run-up of gas prices and so on. The implications are so far-reaching that it's hard to see. I mean, you could have tough action by Obama in connection with it. You could have vicious attacks by Romney, or you could have Romney put in the position where he's forced to support Obama. You really can't predict, but that is the biggest wild card that I can see out there.
Again, I'm speaking with James Mann, a former Washington reporter, columnist, and foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's the author and resident at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the author of many books on global affairs and U.S. foreign policy, including The Rise of the Vulcans, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, The China Fantasy, and his latest book, just out, is The Obamians, The Struggle Inside the White House to Redefine American Power. Now, The your previous book, James Mann, of course, about the rise of the Vulcans, was in in many ways a portrayal of the foreign policy team that George W. Bush brought to the table, and the people that brought us the Iraq War, and I suppose to the Afghan War, although President Obama decided to own that one. I don't know whether he rused that. Does he remember? He basically said Iraq was a disaster, but we took our eye off the ball, and Afghanistan was what we should have concentrated on. At that point, he seems to own that war. Is that his cross to bear, do you think?
Well, anyone who thought in 2009 that he was going to take office and phase out or scale down the war in Afghanistan just wasn't listening in the campaign, because he made that clear all along. He has, and in that sense, he owns war. He has done a 180-degree turn on his military strategy. So in 2009, the idea was to send more and more troops because he bought into the idea of counterinsurgency. He may claim now that he didn't, but that is what happened in 2009. And after 18 months or so, without admitting that he'd been wrong on that, he saw the wisdom of switching to a strategy of counterterrorism, which means less reliance on troops, but more on drones.
And now that we have all of this fratricide, where the people that we're helping, the greatest number of casualties are now coming from Afghan soldiers who turn their guns on their American trainers, and this seems to be happening on a daily basis, and is responsible for most of the casualties as the war is winding down. That surely does, in very stark terms, doesn't it, James Mann, sort of indicate the kind of folly of this war and the dubious nature of what we're going to leave behind?
I'd take it a step further. I think it also changes the underlying politics in the sense that it gives within the military a strong sense that, you know, what are we doing here? If you have the people who are actually fighting the war increasingly afraid that the people they're supposed to be defending are going to turn their guns on them, then you have a military that's not particularly eager to stay as long as you can, or to simply show that we can win this war. And that's a major change.
So I sort of digressed a little to Afghanistan, but I was about to ask you about the going back to your earlier book on the rise of the Balkans. It does strike me as an irony that the entire foreign policy team that Mitt Romney has are pretty much the people who brought us the Iraq War. And I was just noticing in the Los Angeles Times that there's a story that the Obama administration is desperately trying to weigh in on the Iraq government, the people that we put in power, to stop breaking the sanctions against Iran. So there in a way you have it. The neoconservatives brought us this disastrous war that's benefited Iran, and to the point now where the White House is begging the government that they put in, and at the enormous expense of blood and treasure on the part of Americans, and asking them to help them out, which of course is a somewhat futile, I would think. What do you think that Obama's going to bring up? This idea that Mitt Romney will be a throwback to George W. Bush, if indeed the people who are in his team are the ones that are going to run his foreign policy, which he appears to be outsourcing to the neoconservatives.
Couple points on that. First, I mean, I agree about Iraq and the direction it's headed on its relationship with Iran. On the Republican team around Romney, or what Romney's foreign policy people would be, I think there's a little bit of crying wolf here, or, you know, the sky is falling. There are some neoconservatives in Romney's team, and a bunch of people that aren't. It really isn't the same cast of characters by and large. When I look up close at it, there are quite a few differences. It's notable who's not there. Cheney's too old and sick. Rumsfeld's too old. Wolfowitz isn't there. And there was a little action about the week before Ryan was named that was kind of revealing. Romney announced that the coordinator who would put together his transition if he won this election was a guy named Robert Zoellick, who was head of the World Bank, very much, and the right wing was up in arms, complaining because Zoellick is considered, within the Republican perspective, a moderate. And that's just one position. There's another. I noticed that for Secretary of the Treasury, there's a former Bush 41 alumnus named Robert Kimmett. Well, these were the two guys who worked at the right hand of James Baker. I mean, there isn't much of them. Of a grassroots moderate Republicans, that's hard to find them out there. But within the Republican elite, you still get some of the spectrum. And so it's possible that some of the people who worked for Bush may come back. But I think, I'm frankly not sure we're going to find out. I think probably... I would hope Obama does better than that. But if Romney were to win, I'm not sure that it would be a return of the Bush team at all.
So, James Mann, then, is that to say then that that the idea of the neoconservatives taking over has been exaggerated by those within those ranks who are promoting themselves? I mean, John Bolton has more or less indicated that he would like to be Secretary of State. So is that just self-promotion?
And I used to sit there at the L.A. Times Washington Bureau, and you could tell who wanted to be have a job after Election Day, because down around January, February, March, all of their articles and their press releases and anything they had ever did would arrive in the offices of the LA Times or other major papers. And Bolton was always top on the list. Bolton may be promoting himself, but to be honest, I actually think that there's a bit of a... He is a name around which the left can coalesce. And so there's a bit of putting him forward as having a greater chance than he has, I have to admit.
Well,
I don't think it's going to happen.
Sure. Well, just returning to your book, James Mann, where you've taken us into the back rooms of the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, the CIA, to reveal the interplay between the events, foreign policy events that have taken place, the ideas, the personality, and the conflicts that drive American foreign policy with this extremely different group of foreign policy people on the National Security Council, not... a new inner circle, if you will, relatively youthful advisors, some that came out of a kind of humanitarian foreign policy, like Samantha Power and others. As we started out saying that, you know, maybe the foreign policy record, which Obama, I think, is his strong suit, somehow isn't really getting a lot of traction. Is it the irony, James Mann, that if we are at war, good war, bad or indifferent, and it's hard to find too many good wars, that becomes the focus of everybody's attention. But when you're getting out of wars, people forget about them. I mean, the Obama's virtue, I suppose, is he is getting us out of wars. And Bush's sin was that he got us into wars, particularly ones that went badly. Is that a problem, that unless we're in the midst of a shooting war, nobody seems to care?
It is something that has happened over and over again. I mean, I'll phrase this. I agree that is correct, that foreign policy becomes less and less of an issue. And to put it in nonpartisan terms, in this particular case, it's true for Obama. Many analyses of the 1992 election that Bill Clinton won rely on the fact that the Cold War was over and foreign policy wasn't an issue. So... If the Cold War had still been on, then that would have Clinton didn't have foreign policy experience, and George Bush Sr. had it in spades. But the country felt free to register its concern on domestic issues. That's why Winston Churchill lost after World War II as well. So there's a lot of history for this, but it's certainly true. But I don't know that it's negative for Obama. It means that he has just deprived the Republicans of the issue that they have run on election after election, dating back to, I don't know, the 50s, that somehow the Democrats are weak on defense.
Well, James Mann, I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with James Mann, who's a former Washington reporter, columnist, and foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's the author in residence at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's the author of many books on global affairs and U.S. foreign policy, including The Rise of the Vulcans, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, The China Fantasy, and his latest book just out is The Obamians, The Struggle Inside the White House to Redefine American Power. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the standoff at the Ecuadorian embassy in London where Julian Assange is holed up. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Hayden, who is the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society. He was active in the anti-war movement and went on to serve for 18 years in the California legislature. Currently, he works on projects aimed at ending the United States' current wars, stopping sweatshop labor, and protecting the environment. He's the author of The Long 60s, from 1960 to Barack Obama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Hayden.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And Tom, I know you've been following the Julian Assange WikiLeaks case. You've been to London a few times to discuss it with people over there. I have been calling my friend this morning, Phil Knightley, an investigative reporter,
yes.
A very, very prominent investigative reporter who specializes in intelligence. He put up some of the bond money for Julian Assange, the bail money. And obviously, I thought he was the perfect guy to talk to since Julian has skipped bail and is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy. But he read, Phil read to me a summons from the Malabon court in London, where he's to appear on September the 4th on a bail revocation hearing. And he's been advised by his lawyers that he cannot talk about the case, otherwise that will jeopardize his bail money. So it was an odd situation to be in, where somebody that knows Julian Assange well, who put up his bail money, is not able to talk about the case. So, you know, what can I do?
Call Tom Hayden.
Well, good. All right. Well, let's.
So far as I know, I'm able to talk.
Good. Well, let's talk about it then. What today in London, Julian Assange spoke from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy.
I know that. Yes.
Somewhat like Evita, he basically said that the United States should end its witch hunt against WikiLeaks.
Yes.
So what's your sense then of, obviously, I don't imagine that will happen, but in terms of the standoff that we have in London, do you have any sense that it's going to end? Because interesting enough, the judge in charge, who's now his lawyer, is Judge Garzon, the famous Spanish judge who was responsible for the extradition of Pinochet, who was arrested in London under a Spanish warrant, a very similar case to what we have now with Sweden. And now Britain is saying, oh, we have to do what the Swedes request because we're a member of the European community and that's our obligation. But when a Spanish court asked for the extradition of Pinochet, they took the opposite position, at least Margaret Thatcher did.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that the United Kingdom has spoken with a forked tongue. It's just the way of the world. In this case, Mr. Assange could not have a better international human rights lawyer. If you're asking me, you know, where it goes from here, the people I've spoken to are a bit perplexed. You're in uncharted territory. I think it'll be the next stage will be negotiated behind the scenes with the United States an interested party, but Sweden and the UK and Assange's attorney will be in the negotiation. If it goes nowhere, and if it drags out, then I think Latin America will get involved. It'll become polarized between Latin America and the U.S. and the U.K. And at some point, I think Assange has to make a tough decision, because he can't stay there forever, and he may have to challenge British prerogative with Ecuadorian support and get in a vehicle and head for an airport.
Well, but the minute he gets out of that building, he'll be arrested.
That's right.
So that's...
That's right. It'll go, or the British will have to back down. That's why negotiations are a preferred route when you get reputations at stake. But it may have to be settled, in not simply a court of law in the United Kingdom, but the European Court on Human Rights, because you don't know for sure what law takes precedence. The British claim, it's almost an imperial claim, that they have the right to intercept somebody who's been granted asylum by another country. And under the asylum conventions, generally speaking, a country like Ecuador is not supposed to be subject to any retaliation by another country for having granted asylum to someone. So they'll assert that Julian Assange should not be arrested, that it's an invasion of Ecuadorian sovereignty, that it's a trumping of international law, that they have a right to transport him to an airport, put him on an Ecuadorian flight to Quito, and that's it. But you can see how once reputations get enmeshed in this, how difficult it will be to reach a resolution, unless he forces the issue, Assange forces the issue, and it winds up in court, and he'll have to probably wait in jail, go through another bail hearing, and the rest of it. I may not be imaginative enough, Ian, but I don't know how many other options there are, and I'm only speaking for myself here.
Well, I think, though, you raise a point, Tom Hayden, at least to my mind, and that is that the question now would be, how much is this a result of the kind of irritation or vengeful resolve of those authorities that feel that this guy has stiffed them and is poking them in the eye? And as much as he's jumped bail in England, the argument I heard the other day when I talked to a specialist British extradition law at Chatham House was that he has essentially, that the British 1987 Act that allows him to revoke the diplomatic status of an embassy,
right,
which came as a result of the shooting of the British policewoman in front of the Libyan embassy, is based upon the idea that it is the Ecuadorians who are breaking the law by not honoring the host country's laws, which they claim Assange has broken by jumping bail.
Right.
Now, similarly, you can argue that is the case with the Swedes. The Swedes are they acting at the behest of the Americans and the CIA, or are they simply angry at this guy because he poked them in the eye and said, "Screw you! I'm not going to go into your courts. So what do you think is going on here? Is this a subtext to arrest this guy and take him to the United States, or is it that the Swedes and the Brits are just angry at the way he has thumbed his nose at them?
Well, I don't. We could talk a long time. I don't know if we get to the bottom of motivations. I do think, another path has always been open, which was for Assange to go to Sweden and to face the charges against the women, if the case even comes to trial. And I think that he's not wanted to do that because, frankly, it's enormously humiliating. He would argue, his friends would argue, that he'll be extradited if he ever gets to Sweden. But he could obviously be extradited from London. I just don't think it's true that Sweden is a closer ally of the Central Intelligence Agency than the UK. But that's my opinion. The Assange people don't agree with that. They're deathly fearful that once he gets to Sweden, it'll be a trap. So I don't know the motive, but I mean, you're right that the British have passed a law, which I don't think that they will implement because it would backfire on them. But they have speculated that they could simply, by a unilateral act under the British law, revoke the diplomatic status of the Ecuadorian consulate, go in there and snatch Assange and take him out. But the reaction to that in Latin America would be unbelievable, and perhaps, everybody but three or four countries in the United Nations would be negative. And it would draw more attention to Assange and more attention to WikiLeaks and more attention to what's at the root of this, which are the shocking and embarrassing and scandalous documents that he released about civilian casualties and secret armies and so on and so forth. So it remains to be seen, but I'm speculating on your program this morning, at least, that if it can't be negotiated, and I don't see how it can be negotiated at this point, he will have to, with Ecuadorian support, take a step and test the British resolve. They will stop his car, they will arrest him, and then you'll have first a trial on that and then eventually a trial on extradition. And I think that the British may well lose, but Assange may well have to go to jail in the interim.
Again,
it's just a cycling. He'll go to jail, he'll seek bail, he'll be denied bail because he's skipped bail now. He'll sit there, and it will go on through the appellate stages, and he may be finally granted the right to leave British soil and head for Ecuador.
Well, just in closing then, Tom Hayden, I mentioned earlier the Pinochet case, which ironically, of course, was the prosecutor in that who issued the warrant for Pinochet's arrest was Judge Garzon, who is now the legal advisor to Julian Assange. In October of 1998, Pinochet was arrested in London, and he was finally released in March of 2000. And instead of being extradited to Spain, which was the obligation that the British had, Margaret Thatcher decided to reward Pinochet for apparently his covert help in with the British intelligence during the Falklands war against Argentina. At least that's what we've been led to believe. So already, the British have sort of lost the moral high ground, at least in terms of this argument, because of that precedent. What would concern me is that if the British do invade a foreign embassy, Won't that have set a bad precedent, for example, next time somebody tries to escape from the Chinese authorities and go into the American or British embassy in Beijing, they'll be turned away? I mean, isn't that really a threshold that we shouldn't cross, or that?
No, Ian, you're right. One hopes that the White House is able to think down the road in the way that you just have. The implications of this are enormous. What is a very interesting sign that hasn't been given enough attention is the selection of Balthazar Garzon as the attorney for the reasons that you give in the Pinochet case, which exposes the hypocrisy here of the Assange case. I also think that Garzon is a brilliant lawyer, and I hope that we hear from him soon articulating the case and mobilizing an appeal, because at the moment it's kind of tawdry. You have these dismissive descriptions of the WikiLeaks founder living in this little room or giving perorations from the balcony, and the bobbies on the street are going to get him, and the guessing game about whether he's going to be smuggled out. Somebody has to say, no, this is about international law. There are many questions here, and a small country, Ecuador, has an internationally supported right to provide asylum to somebody that they fear will be politically persecuted. And it's not for a former colonial power to prohibit the Ecuadorians from taking a taxi to the airport. It's a big power versus small power issue. And I think Garzon not only has an ethical case to argue, a human rights case to argue, but a sophisticated legal argument. So we shall see. I'm surprised that we have not heard from Garzon. I don't have an explanation of that, but he should be at the microphone soon.
Well, Tom Hayden, already, of course, in his speech from the balcony today in London, from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy, Julian Assange did make reference to the Russian punk band Pussy Riot. So we can see that all of the issues about journalistic oppression, freedom of speech, and the precedent of people seeking asylum, much, much more is at stake in this, obviously, than just the fate of Julian Assange.
Yes, I agree with you, Julian Assange is central to it, Bradley Manning is central to it, and attention will only be turned back to the content of the WikiLeaks revelations when and if the day comes that Assange is on trial in a courtroom where a lawyer like Garzon tells the judge that he wants introduced as evidence the 150,000 documents about the Iraq War released by WikiLeaks.
Right.
That will be a moment that I think everybody that's party to this has to focus on, including Barack Obama. Do people seriously want that trial to go forward? I think that Assange would win that case. It would be hard to get a jury of 12 having gone through the WikiLeaks documents, if the judge permits, to then convict him. I don't see it, but I went through the same thing with the Chicago conspiracy trial. I was advised by my lawyers that we didn't have a chance. It turned out that we did. I can understand why he fears to go to Sweden and fears to be extradited to the United States, but I'm not sure how this ends without a serious legal confrontation and debate, either about extradition or about the subject matter of the WikiLeaks documents themselves.
Well, Tom Hayden, I thank you so much for joining us here
today.
Thanks,
Ian. Have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Tom Hayden, who is the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, California. He's a founding member of the Students for a Democratic Society, and he was active in the anti-war movement and went on to serve for 18 years in the California legislature. Currently, he works on projects aimed at ending the United States' current wars, stopping sweatshop labor, and protecting the environment. He's the author of The Long 60s from 1960 to Barack Obama. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Iran's response to the possibility of Israel targeting its leadership and its nuclear and rocket scientists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously in this forthcoming election, it's going to be a close race. If everybody who voted in 2008 were to vote, Obama would win in a landslide, but there's a lack of enthusiasm on his side. Enormous amounts of money is being spent by super PACs to elect Romney and Ryan, and you also have a lot of voter suppression. But then you have this other thing called the wild card in terms of foreign policy, and foreign policy is not very much an issue in this campaign, but it could be if you are following the Israeli press. It is a buzz with rumors that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak are determined to attack Iran before the elections. What is your sense, Trita Parsi, of how real this is?
I find the likelihood of the U.S. attacking Iran before
Israel attacking Iran.
I find the likelihood of Israel attacking Iran before the elections as also being somewhat small, probably no more than 15% and 20%. I think the Netanyahu government draws a tremendous benefit from issuing these threats, because these threats have been a tremendously successful strategy for the Israelis to push the United States and the entire world to impose unprecedented sanctions on Iran, making the threat that unless sanctions are imposed, the Israelis will take military action. So in these circumstances, for the Israelis to continue that tactic would be successful if the United States succumbs to the pressure and imposes further sanctions on Iran and gets itself even deeper into a conflict dynamic with Iran. On the other hand, if the Obama administration were to push back and try to resist this pressure, then that would also arguably work in the favor of the Netanyahu government, because it would accentuate the difference that exists between the between the Obama administration and a prospective Romney administration, which then, in the analysis of both the Israelis, the Romney camp, and the Obama camp, would benefit Romney in the elections. So making the threat is essentially a win-win for Netanyahu. Actualizing the threat of actually going and bombing Iran brings, however, completely unpredictable circumstances into play. And that's why I think that the Netanyahu government is taking the opportunity of issuing this threat perhaps for one of the few last times, because once the elections are over, and particularly if Obama wins, the Israelis may believe that the likelihood of that strategy of issuing threats and pressuring the U.S. in the desired direction will not be as successful any longer.
So just hypothetically, though, given the level of the speculation in the Israeli press, and it's been going on for now for some time, so it's difficult to ignore. And if it's a bluff, it is a very well-crafted and clever bluff. But a lot of people in Israel think it's not a bluff, that it's for real. There's also been a leak, may be dubious, allegedly from the defense ministry in Israel, of very sophisticated attack plans involving cyber warfare, the targeting of rocket scientists and Iranian rocket scientists and nuclear scientists, and possibly the targeting of leadership. Is that playing in Iran? Because what I've seen from the response of the Iranians, the Iranian government, they've been basically dismissing all this as a bluff, just as you've suggested it's a bluff. So is there anybody in Iran? I mean, the idea that attack plans are being leaked makes you wonder about the entire veracity of the leaks. But is there any sense that this may not be so much an attack on nuclear facilities, but an attack on the regime itself?
Well, I would first say that these attacks and various attack plans and airing in the open this type of a debate actually has been taking place for approximately 10 years. It's just it's become much, much more intense in the last couple of years. But this is something that's been going on, and I would say that the general view in the Iranian defense establishment, I would assess as being that if the Israelis actually did have the capability of striking, they would probably have struck by now. The fact that they're not striking and just issuing these threats is something that reveals their lack of capabilities of doing so. But issuing the threat nevertheless has these other benefits, such as getting the world to impose a very, very strict and unprecedented sanctions regime on Iran. The Iranians don't view any attack on the nuclear facilities as stopping there anyways, in the sense that they tend to view this as a war against the regime as a whole, or actually their strategy may be to try to turn it into that in order to be able to draw other types of benefits from any potential attack.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Well, Dr. Parsi, if indeed, again, these are very successful bluffs and very clever bluffs, I'm astounded that the P5 plus one, that is the permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations, along with Germany, have fallen for the bluff. I would assume that supporters of Iran, at least not necessarily supporters of the West, China and Russia, the fact that they're leaning on Iran may have something to do with the fact that nobody would want a war that might end up in the closure of the Straits of Hormuz and the global economy going into a massive depression. That's the downside. So in terms of the bluff being taken seriously, it clearly is, isn't it? Isn't that why people...
Yes, no, as I said earlier on, it's been a very successful strategy because in the assessment of the Israeli government as well as a lot of analysts, we would not have seen this degree of sanctions had it not been for the Israeli threats. At the same time, one also has to make an assessment of what is actually taking place then, because these sanctions have been imposed in an, again, unprecedented number, yet the threats of military action have in no way succeeded. On the contrary, it's still there and it's increasing. So one does have to ask the question of what is the wisdom of the American and the European strategy of going down this route, particularly mindful of the fact that the threats from Israel in no way has been decreasing. Now, of course, one has to keep in mind as well that Iran has been engaged in activities that definitely needs to be addressed, and that there's some significant challenges that are posed by Iran's nuclear program. But the belief that this sanction strategy would be that particularly successful, or that it would be preventing war, I find highly questionable. And again, it doesn't seem likely that we would have been in the, have gone as far as we have now with it, had it not been for the wild card coming in from the Netanyahu government in Israel.
And obviously, one doesn't want to belabor the possibility of talking further about something that's a bluff as opposed to something that's real. But in order to make it a successful bluff, it has to appear to be real. And that's the conundrum we have in trying to analyze this. Do you think that if an Israeli strike were to take place, that the Iranian government would, as it's promised to do, immediately close the Straits of Hormuz and therefore invite American participation?
No, I think it all depends on the success of the strike. If the strike only manages to cause limited damage to the Iranian program, limited collateral damage as well, few civilian casualties, then there's a likelihood that the Iranians actually will do the opposite and actually play the victim card, go to the UN, seek condemnation of the Israelis there, and then make the threat of withdrawing from the non-proliferation treaty using Article 10 in the treaty, which would give them the legal pretext to be able to do so. And by that, request that the sanctions regime that has been imposed on them is lifted. In the absence, we have to keep in mind a lot of these countries that have agreed to these sanctions have done so highly reluctantly, but they've nevertheless done so because of a lot of American arm twisting and because of the threat that unless they did so, Israel would attack. Well, if Israel already has attacked, then I find it quite likely that several of the Asian countries that were at a minimum would stop harming their own economy by agreeing to a sanctions regime that they never really believed in the first place, that they were essentially coerced into participating in. So the Iranians may actually try to take benefit of an attack if it only manages to do some limited harm to it. If, however, the strike is very successful, then I think it opens up the possibility of the Iranians retaliating, including with trying to close the Strait of Hormuz. But I would put the closing of the Strait of Hormuz as a very one of the last measures the Iranians would be taking, because it would invite not only American condemnation and potentially American military participation, but also many of Iran's own allies, such as China, would also be significantly harmed by such a move. And as a result, it would be a very dangerous card for the Iranians to play.
So a lot of analysts are puzzled by why Israel would even be contemplating an attack on Iran at a moment where Iran's foreign policy appears to be suffering severe reversals, with the Assad regime teetering, at least by lots of analyses. And the notion is that the loss of the Assads in Syria would be a huge blow to Iran's foreign policy and would weaken Hezbollah. Presumably, given what happened with the last Israeli war against Lebanon, where the result of that war was pretty much a stalemate, but the leader of Hezbollah, Nasser Nasrallah, became a hero amongst the Arab world. So the assumption would be that an Israeli attack on Iran would reverse the situation in terms of Iran and Hezbollah's possibility of suffering major reversals in the region and be a reprieve for the Assads. Is that your analysis?
I think there's some truth in that analysis, in the sense that the Iranians are definitely suffering a tremendous amount of damage to their standing as a result of their support for Assad and as a result of Assad's butchering of his own people. Right now, I would say that Iran's standing in the Arab world is perhaps comparable to what it was back in the 1980s when Iran was involved in a war with Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which means very low and a huge blow compared to where it was just a couple of years ago. If the Israelis attack Iran, Israel would have done a huge strategic mistake in the sense that the regional conversation right now has shifted away from Israel, has certainly shifted away from the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and has been focusing on the Arab Spring and what's happening in Syria. An attack on Iran would put Israel back at the center of the regional conversation, which is something that the Iranians would be able then to take advantage of, both to benefit themselves, but also to benefit the Assad regime. Now, this all is premised on the idea that the American assessment, which is that the Israeli military really has very limited capabilities to do severe damage to the Iranian program. The Israelis insist that that's not the case and that they have capabilities that the U.S. is not even aware of. But nevertheless, confidence in the Israeli military right now does not seem to be particularly high amongst the top leaders of the American military.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. Tridipasi, the non-aligned movements having their meeting in Iran at the end of this month, August, and Mohamed Morsi, the new leader of Egypt, is going to go to that meeting. That's the first time an Egyptian leader has been there since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. And that's significant in itself. And I take it the fact that the leaders of the non-aligned movement will be meeting in Iran at the end of this month makes it somewhat dubious about the idea of anybody attacking a country where you have meetings of world leaders. So two questions.
Well, you're absolutely right. And what it comes down to, again, is that the timing of these threats have really, A, nothing to do with any particular advancement in the Iranian nuclear program, doesn't seem to be jiving with any reasonably favorable moment from a regional perspective. But the one thing that it does seem to connect with is the American election season. And that's why I would go back to what I said earlier on. This is most likely just another one of a long range, a long row of Israeli threats that have been aimed primarily to affect America's position and actions rather than signaling any real desire or readiness by Israel to take military action.
And just a final comment on the Egyptian leader, Mohamed Morsi, going to Tehran. Is that a big deal?
It certainly is a big deal in the sense that, as you mentioned, there hasn't been any of those visits. One of the things the Iranians had hoped for once Mubarak fell was that it would open up the opportunity for Israel, for Iran and Egypt to renew diplomatic relations, which they so far have not. So it certainly opens up certain possibilities, but Morsi is also walking a fine balancing act. His first visit, of course, was to Saudi Arabia, and one of the things that the Saudis wanted to hear from him was that he would not move particularly close or particularly far in getting close to the government in Tehran. I suspect that he won't, but I think also he understands that from Egypt's own self-interest, having the capability of communicating with the Iranian government in a more frequent and stable level is probably to their own benefit as well. But he doesn't want to signal any significant movement towards Tehran, particularly not under these circumstances when Iran's standing is so low in the Sunni Arab world.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Tridipasi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.